It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Live from Everywhere USA, it's Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
Jimmy is off today. It's Good Friday. The guy works, let's see, he's got a show on Saturday night, right? 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, 7 o'clock in Sacramento. Does 3 hours of radio every day, which, trust me, is exhausting. So he gets the day off, hopefully gets the weekend off as well. This is Joe Concha filling in for Mr. Failla. And we're going to have some fun today. We have so many great guests. I mean, it's scary. You know, let's stick around for Rup Sood, for example. Well, I've never heard of Rup Sood. But I was sent some clips by a colleague. You got to put this guy on as far as how social media will affect the 2024 election for young voters. And he's excellent. You're going to stick around for that. That will be in hour number two. We got Representative Greg Murphy as well. He's from the 3rd District of North Carolina. He introduced a bill to ban DEI in U.S. medical schools. As somebody who has a wife that's a doctor, this is a very good thing. The two important, just to be checking off boxes, lives could be at stake, and that's not something where DEI should be anywhere, for that matter, but especially in U.S. medical schools. And then, of course, we have Lexi Rigdon, a friend of mine, a criminal defense attorney. He's going to talk about Trump's legal cases, including in Atlanta, where Fannie Willis could get thrown off the case, which I would think she'd want to. I mean, when you're a Grey Goose fan the way she is. I mean, who goes to a wine tasting with her boyfriend, by the way, in Napa Valley, and then only drinks Grey Goose and survives, for that matter? Because that's not exactly something you just, you know, you get everything in moderation, so to speak. Anyway, who am I, by the way? Who is this guy talking on Jimmy's show? Well, I am a Fox News contributor. Jimmy and I think, have a contest right now as far as who can appear on the network the most as far as being a guest. And I am also a columnist, currently unemployed on that front. I did work for The Messenger. Imagine this. This thing, this publication raises $50 million just last May. And they burned through it fairly quickly because they hired like 300 people. So you employ 300 people and you open 3 bureaus, suddenly $50 million doesn't get you where it used to. And as a result, while the publication was doing great as far as traffic, and we really had some nice momentum, unfortunately, the cash ran out and the investors got cold feet in a media environment, by the way, where there are layoffs going on everywhere. So great idea. Perhaps the timing wasn't quite there. So looking for some writing work as we speak as far as that's concerned. But basically, who am I? I'm a dad of 2 kids, 8 and 10 years old. They're in camp today, which is costing me a fortune. But what are you going to do, right? I can't have them on the iPads. I can't have them just sitting around here all day while I work. So they're in an indoor, like, dome kind of camp. So that's kind of cool. I didn't have that when I was growing up. That's certainly for sure. And I mentioned the aforementioned wife. I'm a Jersey guy, born and bred. Spent 4.5 years at the University of Maryland and came back here to Jersey. And now I do the Fox thing on a daily basis. Fortunately, I got this nice, beautiful home studio where I just did Faulkner Focus 10 minutes before I came on here from my basement, and then I just turned off one button and turned on another, and here I am doing a national radio show from my basement, which, trust me, if you live and work in New Jersey and you try to commit, or not commit, but commute to New York, you will commit suicide most likely, but if you try to commute to New York, here's what I got to do. You say, well, take public transportation. Uh-huh. I don't have a train station in my town of Wyckoff, New Jersey, so I got to go 3 towns over to a place called Glen Rock. Then you jump on New Jersey Transit, and trust me, I've seen Jell-O move faster as far as these trains because they're stopping every town on the way to New York. So you make like 10 stops before you get to Secaucus, where you then have to get off the train, go up 2 floors, and grab another train that goes into New York, which is always bottleneck because they don't have enough tubes to get under the Hudson River. And then by the time you do all this and then walk to work, in my case, it's about 15 blocks away from Penn Station, you are talking on the dime. I mean, you could almost set your watch to it, an hour and 34 minutes. Just to do that. And then if you drive in, well, forget about it. Like yesterday when we had 3 presidents in town, and the Palestinian protests, obviously, that were around it. It takes maybe 2 hours sometimes for me to get home. So I'll do like a 5-minute hit on Larry Kudlow's show or on Martha McCallum's show. And then it takes 3 hours in terms of commuting, just to get back and forth. It's like Thanksgiving dinner. You spend all this time preparing, hours and hours, and then you eat it in 5 minutes. That's basically commuting to New York. But anyway, speaking of those three presidents that were here yesterday, and that, of course, being the last three Democratic presidents. And look, I'll be totally transparent. I voted for Bill Clinton, 1996. You think about where the country was. We had prosperity in terms of our economy humming along. We also had a balanced budget amendment, so we didn't spend more than we were taking in. We actually had surpluses. I mean, think about this for a second. Surplus? Those don't exist anymore. Clinton declared that he was going to shrink the size of government. The era of big government is over. Declared welfare being over as we know it in terms of passing welfare reform along with Newt Gingrich. So you had Democrats working with Republicans. We had peace. We had prosperity. Why wouldn't you vote for the guy? I don't care what letters next to anybody's name. Now I do, actually, to be totally honest, because that Democratic Party, when Bill Clinton made Donald Trump sound like a wallflower when it came to the border, called them illegals, they're taking all of our jobs, we have to secure the border. I mean, Clinton was as tough on immigration in terms of illegal immigration than anybody. Barack Obama as well. He was called the deporter-in-chief. Got a lot of flack from the left about that. That party's gone, long gone. And Joe Biden's in trouble, clearly. Newest Fox News poll has Trump up 5 nationally. I really don't care about national polls. I care a little bit because it does show trends overall, but it's the state polls you got to look at. And in every state poll that you see, outside of like one outlier once in a while, you will find that Donald Trump is beating Joe Biden comfortably in North Carolina, comfortably in Georgia, comfortably in Arizona, comfortably in Nevada. He has smaller margins in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, but let's face it, he's winning in all 7 states. So Biden, despite having infinitely more money than the Democratic Party does anyway, than the Republican Party, which I find odd. I know the RNC wasn't run all that well by Rona McDaniel, and we'll get to her situation with NBC in a moment. But still, you would think, judging by the rallies and judging by the outrage at this president and this party in terms of the Democratic Party, as far as where they've led this country in terms of inflation, in terms of energy, in terms of crime, in terms of the border and immigration and foreign policy and education, you would think money would be flowing in quite nicely to the Republican National Committee, but they are being outraised something like 3-1 now by Democrats. And maybe part of that is because the Democratic Party is now the party of elites, right? They're the party of big city people and not of the type of folks they need to win as far as blue collar workers, blue dogs in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and so on. So last night was just perfectly emblematic of where this party is as far as their elitism and their inability to connect with the American people. They raised $26 million overall. This thing was emceed by, of course, the insufferable Stephen Colbert. Can you tell the difference anymore, honestly, between MSNBC and late night comedy, scare quotes? Because I can't. And Colbert is completely an activist. We know this, but he's just so pious and insufferable. And I hope he gets some backlash from this from Hollywood, who doesn't like Biden very much for what's going on with Israel, but probably won't happen. But the point is that you look at media in terms of split screens, right? And this was a split screen moment to end all split screen moments. When you have Biden and Obama and Bill Clinton and Stephen Colbert, they're yucking it up at Radio City Music Hall. Only the rich can attend because obviously that's how you raise $26 million. Meanwhile, outside, in terms of one split screen, you see hundreds upon hundreds of protesters calling Biden a war criminal. And that's a big problem for him in places like Michigan, where they have a huge Muslim population and 100,000 people actually voted for uncommitted over Joe Biden in the primary there. So if they lose Michigan, they lose the election and they know it. And that's why you're seeing this 180 as far as Biden now going after Netanyahu and Israel. But it's too late. You're not going to change these people's minds unless basically you put a Hamas flag on top of the White House. That's the only way that he's going to win these folks back. So that's one split screen, the protesters versus the elites inside at Radio City. The other split screen is elites inside of Radio City and Donald Trump attending an officer's wake, NYPD. This guy, you see the pictures, they're heartbreaking. You know, I have 2 young kids, as I mentioned, and he has a 1-year-old sitting on his lap. And you see his wife, you know, glowing next to him. They're just about to start this wonderful family. And now Officer Jonathan Dillon is no longer with us because he was gunned down. And all those presidents couldn't find the time to even mention him, let alone attend this wake. Karine Jean-Pierre, the most inept White House press secretary of our lifetimes. And I'm talking about like even like a mayor's press secretary in some small town in Illinois, like the worst. Can't even say his name. A, because she doesn't know his name and does the whole hearts and, you know, thoughts and prayers go out to the family. Can't even say the officer's name. And obviously Joe Biden has not as well, just like he didn't say Lakin Riley's name, the 22-year-old nursing student who was beaten to death on the campus of the University of Georgia, only would say her name after he was pressured to do so during the State of the Union, and it still got it wrong by calling him or her Lincoln Riley. I mean, that's where we're at as far as that's concerned. But let's get some sound from yesterday as far as what we heard from Donald Trump first. This would be cut one on Joe Biden not going to visit with the family of Jonathan Diller. Cut one, go.
President Biden, President Obama, and President Clinton going to a fundraiser at Radio City. You know the logistics. Would it be possible for President Biden to have got to Massapequa and visited the family?
I'd say within a half an hour, depending on the mode of travel. So, you know, they have some pretty fast travel.
What does it tell you?
I think that politically he can't support the police. I think he's also making a mistake. But I think politically his base won't let him support the police. And I support the police, I would say, at the highest level of any president by far, maybe double or triple. And they knew that. That's why when I walked into that funeral parlor, it was like love.
And that was obviously Brian Kilmeade, who hustled out to Massapequa. He's a Long Island guy himself, to get that sound in that interview with President Biden. Let's play one more cut before we go to break. And this was Jesse Waters. I was on Jesse's show this week, and I got to tell you, of all Fox's programming, I don't play favorites per se, but his show is the most unique in terms of topics, and it strikes the right tone between informing and entertaining, and it's funny. At times, we always get into trouble, Jesse and me, whenever we do a segment together for some reason. But he gets great guests, and it's just unique. It's different than every other offering that we have in the network, and that's a good thing. And that takes a lot of work. It's easy to mail it in sometimes. You know, you could do the same topics over and over again, right? Joe Biden is too old. Who will replace him on the Democratic ticket? Donald Trump, trials, fundraising problems. You know, you could do that all day, but Jesse goes out of his way to get good guests and do some very unique segments, including last night when he interviewed Robert F. Kennedy Jr., obviously just unveiled who his vice president will be as far as on the ticket, that, of course, being Nicole Shanahan, who is quite rich and quite liberal. So that will definitely take away votes from Joe Biden if Kennedy can actually get on the ballot. Anyway, let's play cut four. This is Waters and RFK Jr. talking about Biden snubbing Officer Diller's funeral and the crime in New York City in general. Go.
Joe Biden snubs the funeral of Officer of Diller. He doesn't go. He tapes a podcast and does a fundraiser. Do you think that was a compassionate thing to do?
I don't know what the thinking was in the Biden White House. I don't think it was a good judgment. Let me put it that way. This is a time, particularly now in New York City, when people are very, very concerned about public safety. And you know, we need to support the police, and we need to make sure that law enforcement is protecting every community, but we need to support the police.
There is a common sense Democrat. Speaking of common sense Democrats from yesteryear, that's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Obviously, RFK has his stances as far as vaccines are concerned. They're quite reasonable, you know, particularly when it comes to COVID. That maybe that thing was kind of rushed out, and maybe we should have tested it more beforehand. And maybe it isn't doing all the things that we were promised it would do, like stopping transmission from one person to another, for example, or stopping getting the disease, getting COVID in general. So I don't think he's the extremist that the left makes him out to me, but boy, they are petrified right now of RFK Jr. because they know that he will siphon more votes from Biden, who already, as we just talked about, is struggling against Trump one-on-one. You throw a third party in there like an RFK Jr. and you have Ross Perot all over again. So for your young folks out there, Ross Perot ran for president in 1992, Texas businessman, ran as an independent, and got nearly 20% of the vote. And Bill Clinton was able to get into the White House with just 43% of the popular vote because Perot in the end took more votes from the incumbent, which is normally the way it works, than from the challenger. So they're trying to keep him. The party that wants to save democracy has hired a cadre of lawyers to make sure that RFK Jr. is not on state ballots. That doesn't sound very much like democracy to me. Anyway, this is Joe Concha in for Jimmy Failla. Back with more in just a moment.
Taking the edge off, one story at a time.
America needs to learn how to lighten up.
You're hanging out with Jimmy Failla on Fox Across America. Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Joe Concha in for Mr. Failla. We're having some fun today already, and we will for the next 2.5 hours or so. Anyway, guys and gals out there, we're going to have a great Easter, by the way. At least here in the Northeast, the weather is going to be very Easter-like. And it's rare that you have an Easter in March. You know, I just got done doing the St. Patrick's Day thing, and it's just weird that Easter is 2 weeks behind it. Usually it's like mid-April. I have no idea, and if somebody wants to, you know, educate me on this as far as how they pick when Easter happens. I know it's like 6 weeks after Lent, but then shouldn't the date kind of be the same every year? And it seems like it's all over the place. Anyway, going off on a tangent as usual, do want to play this clip, which I think is very interesting as far as crime in New York City. And the guy that was supposed to come in and actually fix things was a former cop named Eric Adams, because Bill de Blasio, when you look back on the worst mayors this city has had of all time, I mean, of all time, and David Dinkins, I was young during Dinkins, but the city was in pretty bad shape then. But then it got fixed. Giuliani came in, and then Bloomberg after him, 5 straight terms of competent mayors who valued law and order more than anything, and then it just unraveled all in the 8 years of Bill de Blasio because of things like, I don't know, cutting $1 billion from the New York City Police Department budget. How do you possibly do that and think that that's going to improve things? But, you know, that was during the whole defund the police thing at the time, the summer of love of 2020, and de Blasio just jumped on board that train. So then Adams comes in and you think, okay, well, he's going to make things better. And it hasn't happened. I mean, you read almost every single day, it feels like, people being pushed in front of subway cars. Just, you know, they're standing there just trying to get home. They work out a hard day, or they're trying to get to work, and boom, somebody pushes them from behind and kills them. There's a real mental health issue, obviously. It's a crisis in this city that no one seems to want to address. And you say, well, okay, we should just allocate more money towards it. The problem is that with all these people coming across the border and then coming to New York City, and then they get 3 meals a day, hotel rooms, cell phones, ATM cards, I mean, you name it. We're giving these people everything that we have and not protecting people who were born here or came here legally. So Adams, until he declares that New York City is not a sanctuary city and we made a mistake, sorry. I don't want to hear much about what he has to say, but let's play cut 6 for the sake of doing so. This is on 3 major problems he says is contributing to crime in New York City.
Well, it was
1 is recidivism. You cannot continue to have 38 people assaulting transit employees and committing over 1,100 crimes in the city. 2, severe mental health illness. It's a real problem. We see it on our system. People need the help that they deserve, and we are focused on doing that with the entire team that we have in place. And 3, the random acts of violence. It play on the psyche of New Yorkers.
Yeah. Okay. I don't hear any solutions here, guys, right? I just hear a guy talking about what the problems are. I don't hear many solutions on the other end. Anyway, Joe Concha in for Jimmy Failla. Back with more in just a moment.
Reality with a bit of insanity. It's Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
Welcome back, everybody. Joe Concha in for Jimmy Failla. Let's bring in our next guest. Jump right into it. He is the former Arizona Attorney General, Mark Brnovich. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Joe. Good to hear you. And you're one of the hardest working guys in showbiz. So thanks for hosting Jimmy's show today.
Yeah, I did a Faulkner Focus before. I'm doing an evening edit later on Fox Business and then going on Hannity at like 9:45 tonight. So, but the good news is I am the original Joe in his basement, so I get to do all this from my home. So it looks like I'm working hard, but it's really not the case. You know, you take the commute out of anything.
Hopefully they're giving you one of those Joe Biden State of the Union cocktails, whatever they call them. So
Yeah, it's called Red Bull and Pixie Sticks. That's what I'm going with, and it seems to be working. So we're good to go. Hey, I want to get the latest from what things are like on the ground in Arizona, because that's obviously a very key state when you look at the swing states. Joe Biden won it by a hair in 2020, as he did Georgia, as he did Wisconsin, and it seems like those margins, given the polls that you look at with Joe Biden, are just absolutely brutal when you get to the crosstabs as far as his approval among Hispanics, blacks, younger voters, vastly underwater in terms of Hispanics, which is incredible because he won by 30 points in 2020 and now Trump is up six. So that's a 6-point swing. Yeah. But I guess I'm asking is because if Arizona goes Biden's way again, then it's hard to see Trump winning. You know, he would have to sweep maybe the blue wall states again, like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. But Arizona seems to be the most gettable outside of Georgia. So has the tide turned there as far as particularly on the border issue? And obviously with Texas doing their part as far as barbed wire and just doing anything they can to keep people out there, it seems to be flowing over to New Mexico and Arizona at this point. I would imagine Arizonians, if that's what you call Arizonians, that they're very concerned to the point where they're probably wouldn't vote for Joe Biden again or just stay home.
Yeah, well, I've always respected your political acumen. You're not only a commentator, but you understand politics. And clearly the number one issue here in Arizona is the out of control border. And if it's not just the fact that we have a record amount of people illegally entering our country, the cartels have seized essentially control of the border. They're making record profits. People are dying from it. You know, we're seeing homicide rates go up, you know, especially with overdoses amongst young people. There's a fiscal cost. I mean, you know, in places like Yuma, you know, they're spending tens of millions of dollars to provide health care for people entering country illegally. And fundamentally, you know, Arizonans, we're fair folks. And it bothers so many people that the toughest question that people breaking the law, entering our country illegally, they're getting now from Border Patrol is, do they want the free hotel room with two queens or one king bed? And wow. So it's not only dangerous, it's fundamentally unfair. So immigration is definitely a top issue. You know, I've seen the numbers. You know, this is, I think, Trump's race to lose in Arizona. I do think, unfortunately, you know, we've had a lot of mischief within the Republican Party lately, and that could end up being a little bit of a drag because the party's so disunified now. But, you know, as you know, there is a lot of road between now and November. You know, 2 weeks is a lifetime and 2 months is an eternity, and things can always change. But, you know, right now, I think it's Trump's race to lose in Arizona. Arizona is very gettable for him, but I think it also matters, you know, what happens with the Senate race and what happens with some of these other races, and, you know, do they become a distraction and do they become a drag on the party?
And we're talking to Mark Brnovich. In terms of that Senate race, on Carrie Lake, where do you come down? Do you support her candidacy? Obviously, you're not supporting the Democrat, but is that one of the distractions that you may be talking about? Because it seems that she's running kind of almost as a do-over for what happened with the governor's race in Arizona in a couple of years ago. So is there any other – in other words, is that decided that she'll be the nominee, or is there still a process that remains?
Well, you know, there's still a process going on, but, you know, obviously a lot of folks back east have endorsed her and the president's endorsed her. And I think sometimes people don't understand the situation on the ground here. Look, I won twice statewide in Arizona being outspent. I know a little bit about politics in the state growing up here. And, you know, at the end of the day, people do want authentic candidates, but, you know, you have someone that at one point was really far left and then she became, you know, a Trumpian MAGA person, and, you know, and then she's kind of flip-flopped on some issues, and especially earlier this year in January, there was a huge fight within the Republican Party. The chairman, who used to support her, used to be friends with her, helped her get a job in the past, you know, she had recorded him, and that caused a lot of division and cracks within the party. In fact, she was booed at the state meeting, and so there's a lot of division, and one of the things that I say, I have Berno's 10 Commandments of Politics, and one of those rules is, politics winning is about addition, not subtraction. And at some point, there's so much of a pie. And if you keep alienating, you know, let's say alienating the John McCain folks, you keep alienating Republican women, you say you're going to fight on this issue and then you cave on that issue, eventually you run out of pieces of the pie. And so I think that's what's causing a lot of Republicans' heartburn and concern right now, because where does she get the votes? And she's not raising money because, you know, a lot of the business community, other folks just think that she's too alienating. So that's a problem. I mean, politics is about addition, not subtraction. And she's got a few months here to clean that up. But, you know, she should be working, I think, really, really hard to try to do some outreach and try to bring not only Republicans, but independents and bring everyone along into the coalition.
Latest poll out of Arizona, Mark, Emerson College, sponsored by The Hill. Gallego is at 51%, Lake 49%. So, yeah, it's very close. But as you say, she's going to have to bring in some voters, independents. They're the key to everything, right? And then she's going to need a more centrist message. And, my God, just stop talking about the last election and how it was stolen. I hate it when Hillary Clinton does it. I don't like it when Trump does it. And I don't like it when, like, a Carrie Lake does it. Look forward, not back. And I think that's probably more of a winning strategy. Anyway,
well,
we're talking
about – I used to tell people all the time – I'm sorry, John, I stepped over you, but I'm sorry. But as I tell people all the time, it's, look, generals, and I was in the Army Reserve. I mean, bad generals are always fighting the last war. And, you know, America is essentially, you know, an optimistic country. And when conservatives, you know, talk about, you know, the greatness of America and the free enterprise system and entrepreneurship and the importance of private property and home ownership, you know, making sure everyone, no matter who you are, where you come from, has an equal chance to succeed, we win elections. Conservatives, Republicans can and have won in Arizona, but you need to, you know, look be forward looking and focus on what brings people together, you know, entrepreneurship, you know, free enterprise system, protecting private property rights, you know, providing a market where people can, you know, if they, you know, can raise a family and buy a house. That's what people want to hear.
And we're talking to Mark Brnovich, and that's a great message. Are you going to run for public office again? Because you seem to be pretty good at this.
You know, Joe, I've always been a policy wonk, but man, politics is a nasty, nasty business nowadays.
My dad said, you should run for Senate. You could be Cory Booker in New Jersey. I'm like, well, the problem with that is, is that I saw what happened to Brett Kavanaugh, right? And I was voted in my class, and they actually had a category for this. I didn't even know. It's actually kind of a funny story. So I played baseball in high school, and we're playing like a state playoff game, and I'm on deck, and I kind of just look out of the side of my, you know, just glance over at my parents, and I see that the yearbooks just came out, and it was a home game, so where the yearbooks were produced, they walked them out to the parents who were at the game, and my dad goes right to the back of the book, right? And we're like in a 2-2 game in the sixth, you know, and there's like two runners on. I remember this so clearly. I'm like, where is he going? What's he looking at? I'm like, oh, he's looking at the accolades, like who won what, right? And I'm like, well, probably given my grade point average, I'm not going to get most likely to succeed because we had a guy that had like a 4.6 grade point average, like the smartest guy in the planet. He works for NASA now or something. Anyway, so then I just see him look, and he kind of does a double take, and then he looks up at me and just points. I go, what? What happened, you know? As I'm walking up to the plate, I go, so what'd I win? And he goes, you won best party host? I go, oh, crap. They had no idea. My parents went out every weekend. They have a lot of friends in the area, and they go to dinner somewhere. So I had people in, and, you know, we had kegs, and, you know, we played quarters and beer pong and all that fun stuff. So if I were to run for office, somehow that party would be twisted into something much more sinister, and that would be the end of me. So I think I can't run for public office just because of that. And I was a bookie in college, I got to admit. I took bets for my my friends away. Well, attorney house.
You and I have a lot of things in common. Well, first of all, I went to Arizona State, so I understand the keg party. I totally get that.
Sure.
Not the Republican Democrat party, keg party. Two, this is a true fact. I held the dash in before the current ASU president tore down all the old bars. I held the dash in pitcher drinking record at one point. I'm very
really?
Proud of that. And I was also a member of the Cannery Row Hall of Fame before that was torn down. So, you know, I'll tell you what, if ever we're in a pinch anywhere in the third world and you need someone to slam a beer, I can ride that horse for you.
So. There you go. You're like Kavanaugh, right? I like beer. You declared it.
I'm not like Kavanaugh.
Right. But no, you're not like Kavanaugh. That's totally true. Wait, can I ask when you graduated? No,
but, 1984.
Oh, you're 84.
I'm sorry. Oh, my God. Now, see, you got me confused. We're talking about beer. No, I graduated from high school in 84. I graduated from college in 88.
Okay. So I had a friend that went there, graduated in 93. And he was partners with a guy named Benny Silman, who carried out the biggest point shaving scandal in Arizona state history.
Yeah, no, I remember that. I used to be a federal prosecutor, and I used to prosecute gambling crimes. And I was a state gaming director at one point. So I have a lot of experience with gaming. And in fact, when I first ran for office, I had never run for office. I was running for AG, and newspapers, the liberal media here would describe me as an expert in I have a background in an expert in gambling. And I'm like, what does that mean? Like, I'm a card shark? Like, I have experience in gambling? I mean, I'm like a bookie, you know? Yeah, so it's, anyway.
But oh, my God.
Out. You know, here I am talking to you on, you know, Good Friday. So
yeah, exactly. Good. The holy day, and we're talking about this blasphemy. But just to get the audience, if you didn't hear about this, in 1993, Arizona State had this star player, like, you know, NBA-type caliber player named Stephen Headache Smith. Headache was his nickname. And Headache liked to bet, and then he got in deep with one of the bookies on campus. So then the bookie turned around and said, okay, if you could just not score quite as many points as you normally do and keep the underdog like within striking distance, we'll go to Las Vegas and we'll bet on the underdog. And, you know, that's that. And he agreed to it. And millions of dollars was won by several people as far as this was concerned. Then obviously it's college and people talk too much and word got out. The mob got involved somehow, and that was the end of it. But it's a great documentary on Netflix if you ever want to see it, about Stephen Headache Smith in Arizona State. Anyway, I've totally gone off on a tangent here, Mark Brenovich. So let's get back to reality. What did you think yesterday of that split-screen moment where Donald Trump is attending the funeral for Officer Jonathan Diller, NYPD, gunned down, father of a one-year-old, obviously husband. And then there's Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Stephen Colbert, Radio City Music Hall, raising $26 million and not uttering one word about that officer. I mean, I think that was such a striking moment.
Yeah, I think the dichotomy, what exactly you're describing, in a lot of ways was really, really heartbreaking, I think, because you know, we've heard this expression, limousine liberals, and people talk about it. Well, what does that mean? What does it not mean? To me, that epitomized it in one screenshot, as you said. The fact that you have these people that all went into politics. Let's not kid ourselves. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Joe Biden all went into politics, you know, relatively, I would say, poor, relative, you know, to the general population, and all have come out on the other end now as multimillionaires, yeah. You know, world brands. And they're raising all this money at you know, Radio City Music Hall with all their celebrity friends. And meanwhile, New York City is on fire. There is a dumpster fire. No offense to people in New York. I was just there a couple weeks ago. And there's, like, homeless people on the street, people yelling at you.
Yeah.
I'm afraid to stand by the subway thing because I'm afraid someone's going to push me in or right. worried about it. I shouldn't say afraid. And there's crime. I mean, in any society, when people start killing police officers or government officials – that's when you know you're on the brink of anarchy, because that means that the criminals think that they're immune, that they are really, truly above the law. And so there's no consequences. What's happening now with the crime, homelessness in New York, and I worry we're going to be in this spiral. And the fact that, you know, what's the cliche about, you know, Nero fiddled while Rome's burning? I thought to myself, there they are at Radio City Music Hall, drinking, BSing, raising money, making money, you know, showing up in their limousines, and meanwhile, hardworking blue-collar folks in New York, you know, police officers are being gunned down. It's like, have they no shame? Couldn't they have put that or, like, put it off for a week or two? I mean, the limousine liberals would have showed up 2 weeks later. I just think it was so insensitive and just is such a sign of really the decline of not only New York City, but I worry about the decline of America.
And you talk about elitism. The 10 richest districts in the country all are represented by Democrats. That's all you need to know. But as you know, as a former attorney general, and I'll leave it here as my last question, but Joe Scarborough, who once begged to be Donald Trump's running mate back in 2016, interviewed him 41 times, including multiple times by phone, and then suddenly when the audience turned on him, then Joe had a change of heart as far as Donald Trump's concerned. But today he said that, I know facts don't matter to Donald Trump, but crime rates keep dropping. Crime, in fact, the rate is lower now than when Donald Trump was in office, lower than it was in 2020, and slightly lower than it was in Trump's best year as it pertains to crime in 2019. Now, I see these stats, and I know what I feel and see on the ground and see on the news every night as far as violent crime. Is crime down because we're just not prosecuting as many people? Is that a decent theory, would you say?
Yeah, I'm reminded of what Mark Twain said. There's lies, damn lies, and then statistics. And the reality is that, you know, you can manipulate data, but if you talk to most hardworking folks, taxpayers, wherever you're at, they will tell you that they feel less safe. And whether that's a result of you know, people dying from drug overdoses, whether it's just the fact that people aren't going out as much, or the fact that in these liberal cities like in Chicago and New York and L.A., they're not prosecuting crimes under $1,000. And so you're seeing this huge other spike. My goodness, I had a friend that just went to San Francisco, and he was told to leave his car unlocked because otherwise people will break in to see if there's anything to steal. So he's better off leaving it unlocked. So let them take whatever they want and not damage the vehicle. I mean, this is third world stuff. And so the reality is that things are worse than they were before. It's more dangerous. And remember, there's going to be a lagging indicator. I worry we're going to see this surge with all this illegal immigration that happened. There's a lot of quote-unquote bad hombres that have come in, a lot of gang members. We're seeing now the MS-13, other South American gangs. Yeah. We have a huge influx of people from the Middle East that have been unvetted, people on the terror watch list, a record number. So what I'm worried is not only do we have this spike right now, but we are going to see a huge spike in the next 5 or 10 years because of all of these people that have come into the country illegally. And there's a lot of, I mean, there's people who want to better themselves. I get that. But at the same time, even if it's 10%, you're still talking about a million bad people. I mean,
many lives will be affected. Just ask Lake and Riley. And I'm sorry to cut you off, Mark. They're telling me heartbreaking. You know what that means? So, hey, great to talk to you. And next time I'm out at Arizona State, let's grab a pitcher or two of lemonade.
Right on. It's on me.
All right, done deal. I think I could do that. This is Joe Concha for Jimmy Fallon. Thanks again, Mark Brnovich. Back with more in just a moment.
This is Fox Across America with Jimmy Fallon.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Fox Across America. I am Joe Concha in for Jimmy Fallon. If you listen to this show on a regular basis, you know I join Jimmy. It's like once every 2 weeks, it feels like. And always, somehow, the conversation morphs into gambling, which I don't do. I do like fantasy, and I do like I'm around the edges. We'll put it that way. I have like 3 NCAA pools where I actually have my Final Four is still intact. I know I kind of went chalk, but I mean, we really need Clemson to get beat by Alabama on Saturday. That would be awesome. Anyway, baseball season started like a week ago in Seoul, South Korea. And then yesterday it began here in the States. And I'm looking at the calendar. It's like, it's March. Like, I need something resembling April before I have regular season baseball. But there were the Yankees beating the Astros yesterday. Came back from a 4-0 deficit. Anyway, Joe Concha in for Jimmy Fallon. I just wanted to get that part in that I think that baseball should start in April. And we'll be back with more in just a moment. Stick around.
Live from everywhere USA, it's Fox Across America with Jimmy Fallon.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Joe Concha in for Jimmy Fallon. There was a slight pause there before I started talking because I'm actually in shock. Some friends of mine are sending me these stories as far as... Oh, by the way, I'm a Fox News contributor and I write media and politics columns, best-selling author, and dad, and husband, and currently on a diet. Now you know everything you need to know about me. The diet's tough, by the way, I gotta say. I can't eat until like noon every day because I'm doing that intermittent fasting thing that takes like 16 hours. So if you eat, you know, like 7 o'clock the night before, then you can't eat again until like 11 o'clock or noon. And I've tried to cut out all bread, which is hard sometimes because my wife makes excellent quesadillas. And that's why I have like a quesadilla without like the roll that goes that makes it a quesadilla. And that's annoying. But, you know, it's tough, man. You get to my age. I won't reveal exactly what that is, but let's just say I'm on the back nine, I think, at this point. The metabolism just stops. It's remarkable. I used to be able – I'll put it this way. In high school, 2 times a week, we would race all the way across town, Wayne, New Jersey, to the closest McDonald's so I could have a Big Mac, fries, and a milkshake 2 times a week. And I played 3 sports and somehow was thin as a rail. Boy, that bothers me. I haven't had a Big Mac – 2013. Yeah, 11 years. I remember the year the last time I had a Big Mac. It was the year my daughter was born. So I had to like live at the hospital for like 2 days, you know, while my wife was recovering. It was a C-section. So I think it's just one day that there's like a McDonald's right next to the hospital, which is ironic on many levels. And I'm like, hey, you know what? I'll celebrate. I'll get a Big Mac. That was the last time. Anyway, the point is that I think the trick is not to get large in the first place. And I'm not large. I mean, I think some of you guys see me on TV. But if you take the shirt off, I look like the Stanley Cup. I mean, it's just it's all going to the side and the back. I have back fat. Like my stomach actually isn't all that big. Everything's in the back and the sides. And I don't know. My wife, who's a former Division I athlete, track, mind you, She looks at me a little differently, I got to say. Beauty's only a light switch away, but that trick only works so many times. What? Where the hell am I going with this? I do want to talk about what happened at NBC News and the fact that, and guys behind the glass, if you could just find that Nicole Wallace, I should have told you this during the break, Nicole Wallace, sacred sot, where she's talking about the sacred airwaves of NBC and MSNBC. I'm sure we played that this week at some point. I'd love to play that sometime, but I'll give you some time to get it while I set this up. Anyway, the point is that here you had, I mean, there's just so much to unpack here as a guy who covers media. Rona McDaniel, Mitt Romney's niece, okay? You're not exactly hiring like a far-right extremist here, okay? When she does interviews, and I've met her, and she's a nice enough lady, but they're, you know, milquetoast. Like, she's like chat GPT for doing interviews. Like, all right, has all the talking points just kind of like laid out. Not a lot of passion. Kind of like talks like my son's second grade teacher, just like a nice woman who's very, I guess, I don't want to say meticulous, but just, there's just not a lot of there. I mean, let's face it, but she did run the RNC for many years, so she can bring some value. I mean, NBC thought so. They're going to pay her $600,000 over 2 years. That's pretty good for a contributor, I can tell you. The point is that, so they hire her, and you would think it wouldn't be that big of a deal at all. You know, Fox hired Donna Brazile. She ran the DNC. And not one of us went on the air and said, this is wrong, we can't do that. I wasn't crazy about it, mind you, because she did share debate questions with the Clinton campaign while she was at CNN. But I'm like, all right, one strike. She has been on TV for years. She's a very charming woman if you meet her in person. And all right, forgive and forget, and maybe she could bring some value as far as giving us the Democratic point of view, which every network should have. I mean, it's who needs echo chambers? Honestly, they're predictable, they're boring. And MSNBC, they will claim, no, but we do have Republicans like Joe Scarborough. Joe Scarborough, the guy who publicly tried to convince Donald Trump to make him his running mate in 2016. Think about that. When you hear Scarborough now, you know, he's the most anti-Trump guy perhaps out there, which is really hard to do to be on top of that list. Yeah. Oh, you got the sot. Okay. So anyway, we're going to play Nicole Wallace in a second. But here's the thing. Here you have Ronna McDaniel being hired by NBC, and a contributor, remember, she wasn't getting her own show like Jen Psaki got. You remember Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary who negotiated her contract with NBC while she was still White House press secretary, a huge ethical breach. But she's all about truth, and she would never lie. Just remember that and just ask her, right? But Ronna McDaniel's not going to get her own show. She's a contributor, and I can tell you as a contributor, and I guess maybe I'm a different case like Jimmy or like a Clay Travis where we're on a lot. But most contributors are on here and there. You know, most contributors, probably all, actually have a full-time job. Like Nicole Sapphire, Dr. Nicole Sapphire, greatest name ever, great gal. She works full-time in a hospital and then still finds time to do Outnumbered or host Fox and Friends Weekend or appear as a guest. And they send trucks out to her hospital half the time. She has to go out, do the hit, and then go back. My point is that most contributors are on maybe 2-3 times a week. You know, I'm on something like 15 to 20 times a week, but I think that's A, I have a home studio, so I'm easier to book, and B, I've been called a Swiss Army knife where I could talk about basically anything. So I'm not in one lane. In other words, like Dr. Mark Siegel, he's a doctor, so he's going to talk about health issues, and you're going to talk to Jonathan Turley about legal issues. Basically, I could do almost everything. And if I don't know something, I'm willing to admit it, which is kind of a thing that people really should do more. So I never say, well, legally, Donald Trump's going to win this case. I'll say something like, well, if you listen to Jonathan Turley or Andy McCarthy or any sane and sober legal expert, they say this. So that's the whole trick. Just give attribution where it counts. But Ronna McDaniel wasn't going to be on all that often. She wasn't going to be on MSNBC, apparently. She would just appear and probably meet the press once every 2 or 3 weeks. And the meltdown that we saw, and the utter sanctimony of this meltdown, that's what stood out the most. So let's play, for example, Nicole Wallace talking about how MSNBC, that is sacred ground. Cut, whatever, go.
In this instance, NBC News, either wittingly or unwittingly, is teaching election deniers that what they can do stretches well beyond appearing on our air in interviews to peddle lies about the sanctity and integrity of our elections, which Ronna McDaniels did yesterday at Meet the Press. There were no problems. But what we've also said to election deniers is not just they can do that on our airwaves, but that they can do that as one of us, as badge-carrying employees of NBC News. as paid contributors to our sacred airwaves.
Oh, and listening to that, if I cringed any harder, I'd be a fossil. Honestly, have you heard anything more pious than that? Sacred airwaves? Nicole Wallace? The girl who wrote the talking points to get us into the Iraq War? Remember, she was the communications director for President George W. Bush. And now you're telling me that she's the biggest anti-Trump person on the left outside of Joe Scarborough? And Liz Cheney's a hero? Her dad, who was called a war criminal? Those are your heroes now if you're on the left? Nicole Wallace and Liz Cheney? Oh, my hair hurts. But anyway, look, what she referenced, Nicole, is that NBC, MSNBC would never put an election denier on their airwaves. And then, in the same breath, we'll say, and coming up next, we bear hug Adam Schiff as he tells us more about how the 2016 election was stolen by the Russians. I believe that's an election denier. I believe the red carpet goes out anytime Hillary Clinton wants to go on MSNBC or NBC, and she is the original election denier. Remember, she said that Russia stole the election on behalf of Donald Trump and that Trump is illegitimate. That sounds like election denial to me. Or Karine Jean-Pierre, who, remember, came from MSNBC. Now she's the White House press secretary, and she tweeted out several times after the 2016 election that Trump was illegitimate and that the election wasn't on the up and up. I could go on and on as far as all the election deniers that are out there on the left that are completely and totally embraced by MSNBC. And I wish I could go on there and debate these folks and bring up these little facts, but it's never going to happen. A, I'm under contract, but let's say I wasn't. They would never allow someone like me on their airwaves in 1,000 years because I actually come prepared and they wouldn't be ready for what was coming. And not just, I'm not patting myself on the back. You could throw any Fox contributor onto that network to dispute what they're saying as far as not putting on election deniers, and they're going to get the same blowback. And look, think about the people who have shows on MSNBC for a moment. Al Sharpton, for example, go look up if you're part of our younger demo about Crown Heights riots sometimes. Al Sharpton is solely responsible for that. Go look it up. So he gets a show, and the guy could barely read a teleprompter. Just Google that sometime, Al Sharpton teleprompter. It's not a pleasant experience. This guy's a reverend. You'd think like he'd have some experience doing that by now. Anyway, Joy Reid also has a show, in primetime no less. This is a gal who lied about her homophobic blog being hacked, that somehow time travels went back and were able to get into her blog and change everything that she wrote to make her look like an absolute homophobe. She lied about it, apparently even went to the FBI about it. And then, obviously, that didn't go well. Rachel Maddow, she's the queen of Russia collusion. She has a show. Jen Psaki, we talked about her negotiating her NBC contract while White House press secretary. And Jill Scarborough, we talked about him courting to be Trump's vice president. I could go on, but the point is that more speech is better than no speech. And now, for 220 days up until Election Day, you will get only one perspective and opinion on that network across all of their programming. And maybe that's why Fox doubles and triples their ratings every day, all day. This is Joe Concha, in for Jimmy Fallon. Back with more in just a moment.
Call and speak to Jimmy now.
I'm trying to use the phone!
888-788-9910. You're listening to Fox Across America with Jimmy Fallon.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Joe Concha in for Jimmy Fallon. Let's get to our next guest, shall we? Because we got an action-packed show today, and I want to make sure I get everything in. You know, social media is going to play such a big role, obviously, as it did in 2016, as it did in 2020, as far as this election is concerned, especially among younger voters. So let's bring in Roop Sood. He is the founder of Fifth Weapon. Roop, how are you?
I'm doing great, Joe. How you doing?
Outstanding. So tell us how social media, what's going to be different in this election than, say, from 2020 or 2016 as far as the impact that this growing industry, this growing platforms will have on this particular election?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that the influence of Gen Z and millennials this year. In 2028, 48% of the electorate is slated to be Gen Z and millennials, and they increasingly use social media as their source for news rather than the traditional networks.
And this is true, right? I mean, more and more. I mean, we're seeing, for example, Elon Musk in Twitter, he's signing some pretty big names to basically be another channel, more or less, particularly when it comes to political conversations. That could be Tucker Carlson, that could be Don Lemon, that could be Tulsi Gabbard, recently signed with X as well. And that's just one small example. Obviously, TikTok is going to play a big role here as well. Where do you come down, Roop, as far as we're seeing now Congress trying to move ahead and banning TikTok? Obviously, easier said than done. Their pockets are very, very deep. This is the Chinese that we're talking about. And just to ban them, I would imagine, will be in the courts for many, many years. But where do you come down? Is America a better or a worse place with or without TikTok?
You know, that's TikTok has certainly changed the language and in the way people communicate, especially Gen Z, in terms of video content on social media. So in that sense, and all the other social networks have kind of really emulated that, and they're trying to catch up with that. In terms of where I personally come down on it, I'm agnostic in that I'm not sure of the control level, but obviously, you know, control should not be with a foreign government, and that's something that, you know, that the authorities are basically working through. Ultimately, I think TikTok should be run by an American company, to make sure that data is, safe and in the right hands, because, you know, it is increasingly important to make sure that all the conversations that are happening and the messaging that's happening on the different social media platforms is in some ways, you know, overseen. Because one of the things that, you know, that I'm, you know, hyper aware of, especially in 2024, is that, you know, for example, in commercial advertising, when we put out messages, we have to very clearly delineate whether they're sponsored, whether people have received some sort of financial incentive to say those words. However, you know, the same is not true in political advertising. The FEC, the Federal Commission, that has no requirement to disclose that as of yet. So, yeah, so it's an increasingly important space to look at and try and understand. And try and, using the dirty word, the R word, regulate in some ways, because I think it does need bipartisan work on that, because ultimately this is how Gen Z and millennials communicate.
And we're talking to Roop Sood, and you're right about that. Fox News poll that came out just this week, 33% of voters say they are TikTok users. But then when you only ask those under 30, that number climbs to 60% of voters are TikTok users. So that's just incredible. And obviously, President Biden has certainly embraced TikTok. He's using influencers to try to get to younger voters as far as selling his message, whether that be on student loan forgiveness or abortion. You pick the topic. So it's interesting that Biden does say that he would sign any bill that gets to his desk that would either ban TikTok or at least call on them to sell to an American company, so it's no longer in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. But at the same time, boy, he uses it a lot, because that's how you reach voters at this point. As far as Elon Musk is concerned and X, ever since he's taken that over, the platform certainly has changed. In other words, it seems like anybody can be verified at this point. That used to be kind of a process where you'd have to prove that you're part of some sort of news organization or you're some sort of celebrity that's worthy of a check mark. Now it seems like everybody can get them. But overall, do you think that TikTok has made, I'm sorry, do you think that Musk has made Twitter a better or a worse place?
You know, I think it's healthy for any democracy for people to be able to communicate and talk and message. As long as, you know, there does need to be some form of oversight, because, you know, in terms of hate speech and incitement to violence or whatnot, you know, those are things that are not, should not be acceptable in any healthy democratic society. I think Elon Musk certainly has his motivations in the right place. Whether that's actually practically working out from a practical point of view, that, you know, I'm not so sure of, and I think we all need to look at and, you know, maybe you think about a little bit further. But the impetus behind, opening it up and basically making sure that there's a healthy discourse online, I think, is important, because, you know, at the end of the day, the social media sites, you know, they're not officially seen as news sites, but they increasingly are becoming that. So You know, these are all questions that are up in the air, and these are all questions that, you know, we all need to start asking, whether we be Republican, Democrat, or independent, or whatever, because at the end of the day, it's really important for democracy as a whole, for, you know, these conversations to be had in, you know, for these conversations to be had full stop, and then also to be had in a transparent manner. Does that make sense?
We're talking to Rube Sood. He is the CEO of Fifth Weapon. We only got about 25 seconds, but what are your thoughts, finally, as a final question? Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill on Monday banning social media accounts for children under 14, requiring parental permission for 14- and 15-year-olds. I have an 8- and a 10-year-old. I don't want them on these platforms until then, unless it's educational. It's kind of hard to separate the education from the fun stuff. But what do you think of DeSantis requiring 14 and under that they have parental permission to go on these places? And we only have about 20 seconds, I'm told. Sorry.
I think this is a great idea. I think it's very important. I work in social media. I understand how it's used to basically push messages forward, and I understand how it's used to carry people along a certain path. So I think it's, you know, the children obviously do need to be very regulated.
Rube Sood, we appreciate it. Up against a hard break. CEO of Fifth Weapon, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Joe Concha, in for Jimmy Failla. Back with Warren in a moment.
It's the morning show that overslept. Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. This is Joe Concha in for Jimmy Failla. And, wow, we're already halfway through. Radio is incredible. I don't know if I could do radio 5 days a week. I did at one point. 3 hours, 6 to 9 p.m., WOR, New York, number one station as far as talk in that particular large city, largest market in the country, and I never was more exhausted in my life. This was 2019, and then COVID came, and then basically the show was canceled. And I don't mean to laugh about that, but basically you couldn't go into the studio, and I had no home way of doing it, and they just decided that they were just going to lay off 2,000 people anyway, the good folks at iHeart. So that was the end of that. But boy, I was already thinking of ways. I had a 3-year contract. I was already thinking of ways, like, how do I get out of this thing? Because, I mean, I enjoyed it, yes, but there's some stories around this that I probably shouldn't be sharing. But it was difficult on a daily basis. Let's just say I was a one-man band and didn't have much support from the producing. And unlike the good folks at Fox Across America, where they had nice audio lists here and a whole rundown, everything is organized. I had nothing like that when I worked that particular show. My producer, even, I won't name names, even came in drunk one time and then proceeded to throw up in the studio. I can't lie about that. That was pretty much the end for me at this point. But now I'm doing this from my home, as I shared earlier. And I'm the only person here outside of my dog that is laying at my feet, and he looks pretty healthy and not going to hurl anytime soon. I don't know where I'm going with this. I think I have to have an adult conversation at this point. And the way to do that is to talk to Greg Murphy, who is a congressman from the 3rd District of North Carolina. I am so sorry, Congressman, about the Alabama Crimson Tide and what it did to your Tar Heels.
Oh,
last
don't
night.
Let's Shocker. Not talk about it. I'm in quite a depressive mode. I did call a friend of mine who's an NC State fan today and say, normally, you know, I'm a secondary State fan, but now I'm all in for State. Problem is, our Duke folks are still in, and yeah, we're not quite sure Duke is in North Carolina. We think it's more an annex of New Jersey. So. But anyway, great to have three ACC teams still in. So.
Yeah, that's amazing, because the conference was supposed to be weaker this year, and some teams that should have got in didn't, like a Pitt, for example. But I'm a University of Maryland Terrapin, and we used to be in the ACC. Those were the good times.
Yeah, y'all went rogue. Y'all went rogue about eight, nine years ago.
Oh, good, yeah. Congressman. That killed me. I love the ACC. I love playing North Carolina and Duke every year. Now, when I was there, because I'm old, I got to be there during the Christian Leitner, Bobby Hurley, Grant Hill years with Duke, and with North Carolina, Eric Montross, and who else was on that team? Great team. Rodel, yeah. I remember like a three-point shooter that you had. Anyway, you went to the Final Four in 93, and you won the whole thing. You beat Michigan after the unfortunate timeout that Chris Webber tried to call. So you're a Tar Heel then.
We were already winning that game, by the way, against Michigan. So just because Chris Webber screwed it up, we were going to win that game anyway.
Yeah, they were trailing. Anyway. So it wasn't like they had the lead and the timeout led to, you know, technical fouls that North Carolina won. But, that was a right. great – I remember that was New Orleans, and it was a long time ago. But we want to talk about more important
awesome.
Things.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So you just introduced a bill to ban DEI in U.S. medical schools. And I got to tell you, my wife is an ER doctor. I saw the sacrifice that she had to go through where – She was undergraduate Georgetown while running track, mind you. So you're pre-med. Mm-hmm. Then she went to medical school. Then she had to go through her residency, which is a couple of years. You get paid almost nothing to be a doctor. And then finally, like when she was like 31, she finally got to be a full-time doctor. But I couldn't imagine her not having that education, having to do everything she has to do on a daily basis, because when you're ER, you have to know everything about everything. That we're suddenly going to start checking off boxes and allowing people in the medical schools that maybe shouldn't be there.
Well, you know, the sad thing is, Joe, and this is the DEI, which, you know, is the greatest peer pressure event in human history since the Spanish Inquisition. It just is, because if you don't adopt it, if you don't have this, then you're racist, bigot, misogynist, or whatever. So it's just peer pressure. And what's happened now, the head of the American Association of Medical Colleges and University, this is his number one priority, is to push DEI in medical schools. Jeez. Now, look, this has nothing to do with race, color, anything like that. It has to do with me, with merit, with excellence, and patient care. I would love to have a more diverse physician force, absolutely. But we need more doctors, number one. Two, we need excellent doctors, not ones who just got over the bar. And we don't need to lower the standards for anybody. We need to raise them up. And truth be told, Joe, these are conversations that should be occurring now as early as elementary school. So many kids are coming from bad homes, difficult homes, single-parent homes. Yeah. We need to get the kids in elementary school excited about STEM education, study, and so we don't have to lower the bar. We keep the bar up, and then more individuals will be coming in. And the second part, I don't want to talk too long. The second part really is about the curriculum that they're putting in all these nonsense in medical school about climate change, white supremacy, and, you know, your systemic racism. None of this crap belongs in medical school. Good God, we've had an explosion of data and information. We should be learning that. And then finally, what's happened is just hiring and firing, promoting a faculty. You have to sign a fealty oath. And we can give you so many examples of this, that you believe in DEI, you're going to push these narratives and everything. And so it's just very reminiscent of the 1930s Germany and the brown coats. You sign on this line or else you're ostracized. So it has no place whatsoever in medicine, none. And we should be concentrating on more workforce, burnout, access for patients rather than this nonsense.
It's interesting, and I'm looking at a poll here from WITN, and they reached out to Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, Wake Forest, and no one would provide any comment. In other words, they didn't want to respond to a journalist actually doing their job, and a poll taken by WITN shows that 28% of their viewers believe DEI should not be banned, 71% believe DEI should be banned. So you're in one of those 20-30 type of issues where you seem to be on the right side of that at this point. I guess I wonder, is this being done not just for DEI, but also there is a severe doctor shortage in this country. I see it firsthand, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
Where you have my wife works in an urgent care now, and she will see probably today, I'll text her during this interview to say, how many patients have you seen so far since 8 a.m.? 35 to 40 patients, and she only has one assistant. I mean, it's madness. Yeah. And then if she makes one mistake, she gets sued. So how do you address the overall doctor shortage if you don't lower standards?
This is what my frustration with the head organization is. We're not looking about this. We're worrying about, you know, unicorns and all this other stuff. We're not addressing the shortages. And here's going to be a scary fact, Joe. Better sit down for this one.
All right.
That because of some of these practices and getting kids into school, two-thirds, 63% of kids in medical school right now do not plan on practicing clinical medicine. Just think about
wow.
that. Think about that.
Can you repeat that
and
again?
And I remember when I practiced full-time and I taught, I'd have kids that, you know, in their senior year, I'd say, okay, well, what are you going to do? What residency? Well, we're not. And I'm flabbergasted. Why not? Well, I don't think I'm going to practice. Then why the hell did you go to medical school? Why did you take up a spot for a man or a woman who would? And, you know, I get it. People want to have the old work-life balance thing, and they may not want to. But, you know, we're in critical times now, critical times where our emergency departments and urgent cares are blown through the roof because there are not enough regular doctors. And the AAMC is not addressing this. They're going off on a tangent to push a leftist progressive agenda. So, you know, I'm not backing down from this because this is the field I've devoted my life to, just like your wife did. And so, you know, this is important. It's for patient care, and we're destroying it.
And we're talking to Congressman Greg Murphy, Republican, North Carolina. Yeah, it's remarkable when you look at the numbers as far as the shortage of primary care physicians, according to the AMA. We are looking at now, my goodness, by 2034, they project there could be a shortage of 48,000 primary care physicians. And one reason that I hear from my nieces, for example, they're one's at Bucknell, one's at Stanford University, and they originally wanted to be doctors, and then they looked at the cost of being a doctor. And let's put it this way. I mean, we talked about 4 years of undergrad, right, where you have to be pre-med, but then after that, you have to go through 3 years of medical school, and then obviously the internships and residencies.
Four years of medical school. So you got
Four years, of course, why would you do three? So by the time you go through all that, think of the money that you owe. It's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, clearly, and you got to work years just to break even. So I think a lot of people look at that and they say, "Yeah, no thanks. I would love to, you know, save lives, but the cost is too much." Is there anything that I don't like Congress getting too involved with this? But is there anything that we can do to incentivize kids to become doctors more, as far as financial assistance?
Well, in some places, practicing in rural areas and some of the other issues, yes. But, Joe, this actually goes back even further. If you look at when the government got involved in student loans, there has been no impetus, no stimulus, no push to on college and universities, undergrad, to save money. You know, when I was on the board of trustees of my alma mater, the president at the time never saw a new program she didn't like. So what happens is all of a sudden tuition goes up, tuition goes up, tuition goes up. And students, and this is happening in colleges and universities around the country, and then guess who gets stuck with the bill? The students. And then the vote-buying program of Joe Biden transferring debt. By the way, most of that debt actually goes to higher-income individuals at Ivy League schools and everything, is not a fix. We have to start back at undergrad in saving the cost, making that cheaper. Medical school's harder. There's a lot of patient care. There's a lot of, fixed cost in science that goes on. But it's extremely expensive, and it doesn't need to be something just for those who can literally ride it out because of, another spouse being able to pay for it, or, parents' income or whatever. I just think, again, our priorities are screwed up, and it's going out through all the different fields in medicine. It's such peer pressure to push this. We should never, ever, ever step away from our banner of excellence. The tent's a big one. We need to have more folks in medical school, more residency programs. But we also need the people who are going to medical school, taking up a slot to practice medicine, not go off on some tangent and either not practice at all or just practice part-time or work for some other company.
That is incredible. They go through this whole effort. They get there. Actually, we want a do-over. No thanks. And you look at the University of North Carolina, for example, Chapel Hill, and all in, it costs, if you're out of state, right, $40,000 per year. So that's $160,000, plus there's other costs that probably aren't being factored in here. I mean, it's just remarkable when you think about the fact that, okay, you probably have to earn around $275,000 or save it just to put one kid through a state school. Then when you look at like Georgetown, for example, where my wife went, it's like $80,000 per year. I just don't. And what's happening with these student loan forgiveness programs that the president keeps ramming through, despite the fact that the Supreme Court called it illegal because Congress should be able to control those purse strings, not a pen by one authoritarian president. The fact that tuition continues to go up seems to be the biggest problem. Like, in other words, by forgiving these student loans, then you're incentivizing all these campuses, all these colleges, just to raise their rates a little bit more because they'd say, they're probably just going to be forgiven anyway, so we could probably push this up more. Is there any way we can reverse tuitions continuing to climb when the quality of the education continues to decline?
Yeah, we have to look back at the student loan programs. And then, I go back and you look at some kids who graduate, and just talking about undergraduate, with degrees that are absolutely not marketable. You know, one that I just scratched my head at is this gender studies. Fine, if you want to study it, do it as a minor. But if you do it as a major, the only thing you can then do is go to a college university and teach gender studies. Or you become one of these DEI officers, which you could learn, on the back of a note card what to do for that. And it's just, it's absolutely destructive to our society. And, you know, there are excellent, excellent doctors of every skin color. And you know what? There's some bad doctors of every skin color.
That's
true. We cannot afford to lower the bar in medical school because patients' lives, again, patients' lives are at stake.
So precisely.
I feel very, very strongly about this.
Yeah. And my wife got sued one time, Congressman, because and only one time in a 15-year career, which is utterly remarkable considering how
that's lucky. That's lucky.
Yeah, very lucky. And the reason why she was, I won't go too much into it, because the doctor that she was working with missed something, right? But she was part of the team, so she was part of this whole lawsuit. Thankfully, it got dismissed. But that's the thing. One bad doctor could make life very horrible for a very good doctor. All right, so we're going to end it here, by the way, because unfortunately we are up against a break soon. But we do have to go through the 1993 University of North Carolina Tar Heel roster, because I was struggling to remember some players on the team. Yes, there was a guy named Hendrick Rule.
Derek Phelps, right? Wasn't Derek Phelps on there?
Correct. Derek Phelps was on that team. George Lynch was on that team. Brian Reese.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was obviously Dean, who was still coaching at the time. And then I look at the standings that year. North Carolina finished 34-4 overall, 14-2 in conference. Maryland, which was on probation, so I picked a wonderful time to go there, 2-14 in Congress, in conference. So I'm having regrets because I could have gone to North Carolina and I didn't because I thought it was too far. But then I'm looking at your campus when I was interviewing and I'm like, my God, what was I thinking? So when did you graduate, if you don't mind me asking?
I graduated from undergrad in 85 and then medical school in 89. And, you know, just as a side note, sadly enough, we lost Eric Montross.
I know.
Several months ago to cancer. He was a gentle giant, a true gentleman.
I know. I interviewed him one time and just, you know, I'm 5'9" and he's 7 foot. So, you know, I was like, I'm like on a stool type of thing, but yeah, you're right. He was definitely the nicest guy. So you were there during Michael Jordan then?
Absolutely. He's like 2 weeks older than I am.
Oh, is that right?
So yeah. We played ball in the birthing center, and I was 2 weeks ahead, so I got a little head start on him, and then he just sprouted. So, he's from Wilmington, North Carolina. He went to UNC for undergrad, and then the rest of the story is well known. So,
his history, yeah.
I'm only a couple weeks older. Yeah.
Well, Congressman, absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us. This is a very educational conversation, and I say that as somebody who has heard all the horror stories, and hopefully this bill eventually gets to the president's desk and does get signed.
I hate that we have to do this, but when the liberal progressives now have invaded what should be a sacred field of just objective science with their, just subjective nonsense, it's time to stand back and stand up.
All right, a lawmaker actually doing his job. This is refreshing. Greg Murphy, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great Easter weekend.
Yeah, you too, my friend. Take care.
Okay, Joe Concha filling in for Jimmy Failla. Back with more in just a moment.
It's America's number one radio lunch date.
Get your hands out of my fries.
Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
Buy your own damn fries.
Welcome back, everybody. Joe Concha in for Jimmy Failla. This is Fox Across America. I still can't get over this. I got to finish this thought from before. So the NFL is going to have a Friday game as its second game to start the season, September 5th, the 6th, excuse me. And the game is going to be in friggin' Brazil, São Paulo. It'll be the Philadelphia Eagles versus to be determined, which you know is going to be the Jacksonville Jaguars. That team plays out of country more than any probably in NFL history. So they're going. If the Jaguars can get out of here, they will. But, I mean, it's going to be on Peacock. Really? I got to pay to watch Parks and Recreations over and over again? What else is on Peacock that makes it worth it? So I got it for the playoff game last year between the Chiefs and the Dolphins, and then I canceled it. Now I got to get it back again, I guess, when this happens. But this is where it's going, man. I say one day the Super Bowl is going to be on pay-per-view. You have to pony up $100 for it at your party, and the NFL can make billions off of that. That's where it's going. Streaming. Everything's streaming. Joe Concha for Jimmy Failla. Back with more in just a moment.
Live from Everywhere USA, it's Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Joe Concha in for Mr. Fela. We got a phone number. It's toll-free and everything. 888-788-9910. 888-788-9910. If you wish to opine. I don't know if you saw exclusive story, foxnews.com, as far as our Border Patrol union president warning that Joe Biden is deflating border numbers by flying migrants into the country. Therefore, crossings at the border, the numbers may look lower as a result because it's an election year. This is madness. And this same Border Patrol union president says that mass amnesty is coming. Yeah, you think? In New York City, they're trying to pass a law now that would allow 800,000 illegals to vote in local elections. If you're wondering what the whole endgame thing is, right? When people say, well, you know, it's intentional. And at first, I'm like, no. I mean, look, what political upside? I always look at it through that prism, not whether people are good or not good people or inept or completely capable. But in this case, I'm starting to believe the whole, no, I am believing that the whole this was totally intentional thing as far as opening our border. You remember what Joe Biden said in that 2019 debate when he was running for president? He urged people to surge the border. You interview illegals at the border and they say, yeah, Joe Biden told us to come. I mean, it literally, that was the plan, I guess. And now it's to get all these folks to vote in local elections. And obviously they're going to vote more Democrat because they're the party who let them into the country and gave them all the free stuff. I hope this gets shot down in New York. They tried this once before, and at first it was passed, and then another judge overruled it. I guess this is another turn at that. But it won't just be New York. It'll eventually be cities like Detroit, for example, in the key state of Michigan, or a city like Milwaukee in the key state of Wisconsin, or Philadelphia in the key state of Pennsylvania, or Atlanta in the key state of Georgia. I could go on and on. But this cannot stand. You have to be, I'm making the most obvious statement probably in the history of this program, but you have to be a citizen in order to vote. It's that simple. And that's why, I mean, you always hear this cliche that this is the most important election of our lifetimes. This really is. It truly is. Because, A, Republicans will never, ever be handed a more winnable election than this. It reminds me of 2008 in terms of, I don't care who was going to run on the Republican side. No Republican was winning that election, because when you think about it, right, the Iraq War was basically a debacle, right? The surge in the end calmed things down, but the damage was done as far as the perception, and obviously there were no weapons of mass destruction. So when you ask most people now, sane and sober, they'll say, yeah, it was a mistake. So you had that on George W. Bush's resume. Fairly or not, you had Katrina, which absolute joke that he got blamed for that in any way, shape, or form. Oh, he was on vacation. He flew over the site of devastation. Well, yeah. What do you want them to do? Land in the middle of it? That would take all the resources away from search and rescue. So the fact that he got criticized for that because he flew over New Orleans looking down, well, what would you have him do exactly at that time? So I always thought that was a bum rap. And obviously we see the way Joe Biden was treated when Maui happened. Maui wasn't on the scale of Katrina, but still, the guy took, what, 2 weeks to get to Maui, then shared some ridiculous story because he's a pathological liar around how, well, you know, he survived a fire in his home that nearly killed his wife and cat and nearly torched his beloved Corvette. And then you talked to the fire chief who was involved with that fire at the time. He said, yeah, it was out in 10 minutes. It was completely controlled and confined to the kitchen. I mean, come on. So if Trump ever told a lie like that or waited 2 weeks to go to Maui, which was the worst wildfire in this country's history, I'm pretty sure that he would get rightly criticized for it. My point is that, all right, so Bush had that on his resume, and then there was a financial crash, September 2008, right, where you literally had our government hundreds of billions of dollars just to save the banking industry. So it didn't matter that John McCain was, you know, an average candidate. You know, he was like the Schlitz of candidates. Like if you're at a party, it's probably a bad example, Schlitz. Give me an average beer. Bush Light. He was the Bush Light of candidates, where if you're at a party and all the beer is out but there's Bush Light left, you'll drink the Bush Light. You won't go out of your way for the Bush Light. You won't be enthralled by the Bush Light, but you'll have the Bush Light because that was your only option. That was McCain, basically. And Megan's a friend of mine. I don't mean any disrespect, but he was an okay candidate. He was a great man, obviously. But as a presidential candidate, not exactly electric on the trail. And besides, even if he was, Obama was winning that anyway because every single thing was lined up for Democrats to win that particular year, on top of the media, obviously, rooting for Barack Obama. I believe it was my old friend Bernie Goldberg who called it a slobbering love affair. And that's when media changed forever in terms of not just taking a side. They always have, but blatantly just doing it overtly and not caring. It was that election. So Obama was going to win that, and he did win quite easily. That's what this 2024 election should be. When you look at everything the way it lines up right now for Donald Trump, as far as inflation still continues to rise, if I got to hear one more time that inflation's falling, it is the most gaslighty, misleading lie that could ever be told. Just because inflation was over 9% and it's dropped to 3-point-something% now, that does not mean it is falling. It just means it's not rising as quickly. In other words, if I gain 50 pounds and the wife says, hey, this isn't the Joe I dated at the Jersey Shore when we first met, where you would walk down the beach, you know, just completely not Speedo, but, you know, pretty short shorts and no top. And I was very proud of this lean and mean body. Kind of had a Ryan Gosling thing going on. All right. And then suddenly I gained 50 pounds. I'm not exercising anymore. And the wife says, hey, can we get that old Joe back? So then the next year I only gained 20 pounds. I say, see, honey, I've lost weight. No, you haven't lost weight. You just haven't gained as much. That's what's going on with inflation. All right, so on inflation, Biden's vastly underwater in terms of polling. In terms of crime, we talked about it in the last hour with Mark Brnovich as far as crime stats may be down, but that's only because we're just not prosecuting as many people. That's because police forces are being cut and we're not arresting as many people. So that doesn't mean it's falling. It just means that we're not prosecuting the way we should. Because if you ask anybody who lives in New York or Chicago or San Francisco, pick a major city, they will tell you that they all feel like crime is going up because it is. It's that simple. The stats are lies, quite frankly. So on crime, obviously Trump attended that slain officer as far as he was murdered just a couple days ago. Had a one-year-old kid and you know, just a glowing life. I see that picture and my heart breaks. That was a nice family. And this officer was gunned down. And sure enough, we had Donald Trump attend the funeral services for Officer Jonathan Diller. Joe Biden, meanwhile, is at Radio City Music Hall with Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Stephen Colbert, raising millions. So on crime, obviously, you look to Trump. Yeah, he'll probably do a better job on that in the eyes of most voters. Then you look at the border. What else can you say? One wants a wall. One wants to remain in Mexico. One wants to eviscerate, catch and release, and one does not. And if I got to hear one more time, and Senate Republicans are idiots, by the way, the ones that agreed to that bipartisan bill, unless any bill has what I just named, where you restart border wall construction, where you restart Remain in Mexico policy, when you end catch and release, unless a bill has all those things in there, it's not a bill. It's not anything that's going to do anything of meaning anyway. But some Republicans agreed to this and then gave Joe Biden and Joe Scarborough and you know, pick your Democrat or fan here, as far as saying, well, we could have fixed the border. We could have stopped all this from happening. But Republicans and Donald Trump, they made sure it didn't happen. No, Trump is against the bill because it sucked. That's why. Not because he wanted it as an election issue. So that's ridiculous. And most people know it. So Trump is up 20, 30 points in terms of who could handle the border and immigration better. And then foreign policy is a mess, obviously. If the world feels like it's on fire, it basically is. And things were calm when Trump was president. You know, he eviscerated ISIS. I keep using that word. Dropped the Moab. Remember that? The mother of all bombs? And then that changed the tide on that. So that caliphate was eliminated. North Korea was tamed. Russia wasn't walking into other countries, right? China, not quite as aggressive in terms of its posture towards Taiwan. So you look at every major issue and you say Donald Trump absolutely should win because there's not one issue where Joe Biden is leading on, I guess maybe, except for abortion. And it's not 2022 anymore. You know, when Roe v. Wade was shot down at first, then Democrats could run on fear and say, see, there's going to be women in back alleys with hangers and rogue doctors, and it's going to be a nightmare if you want an abortion, if you were raped and you can't get rid of the baby in that sort of situation. Well, tough, you know, and a lot of people believed it. And now we're saying, oh, it's doing exactly what the Supreme Court wanted to happen, which is all these decisions are going back to individual states, and then they're holding referendums in terms of voting, and then it's being struck down, and an abortion is being saved. In these particular states, like Ohio, which is red, Kansas, which is red, they had referendums saying, all right, should we ban abortion? And voters overwhelmingly said no. That's just the way we are at this point as a country. I don't necessarily agree with it. I think by far, I know too many couples, at least three off the top of my head, that have had trouble having kids and they want to adopt like an American baby. It's almost impossible. It really is. And then if you can find a baby to adopt, then we're talking like the type of prices on buying a baby. I hate to put it that way, but that's how it is. There is a market. A lot of people can't afford it. I just wish we incentivize people more. If you're healthy and you can keep the baby, put it up for abortion. You know, maybe you put a price tag around that. I hate to say it that way, but it, you know, if it makes more couples happy and we have less babies being aborted, I see it as a win-win. But overall, my point is, you find me an election where you have all the issues lining up for the Republican, right? And you have on the other side an 81-year-old Joe Biden who, yeah, he could read a teleprompter if you give him a week to prepare and pump enough pixie sticks and coffee and whatever else they gave him that night. Fine, he could read a teleprompter. Anytime he's outside of a teleprompter, it's a cleanup on aisle 1, 14, 17, and 26. Every time. So I don't see how you could have an election since 2008 that lines up quite this way. And Donald Trump, if he didn't have all this baggage, would be up by 20 points right now. Easily. If we didn't have these trials that go on every day. And I know, and I've made the argument myself on Fox that they help him to a certain extent because they are so ridiculous. And the prosecutors are that inept. Fannie Willis, Alvin Bragg, Jack Smith. Most of those trials probably aren't going to be heard, or at least they're not going to conclude until after the election. And then if Trump wins, then it's game over, right? They'll go away completely. So I don't believe they're going to have that big of an impact. But every news cycle seems like every day Donald Trump is back in court. And when that happens, while that helps him in terms of making him a martyr, because we see what's happening with the weaponization of the justice system, on the other side of the coin, we're not talking about Joe Biden and this election being a referendum on his record, especially when it comes to the border and inflation and crime and foreign policy. So you'd want a fair fight here. The only fair fight we're going to get, I guess, are the debates, which usually happen late September and then October leading up to the election. There's usually three. And as of now, you could see how both sides may not do it. Democrats won't do it because they'll say Joe Biden is above sharing any stage with President Trump, who's an insurrectionist and authoritarian and Hitler-loving, blah, blah, blah. You hear it from a mile away. And, of course, our stupid media will be like, yeah, it's true. They shouldn't be on the same stage. Joe Biden, he's a good man, and he shouldn't ever normalize Donald Trump. Like a mile away, you could see that argument coming, right? But then on the Republican side, let's say for whatever reason, like NBC is awarded a debate. And then they have like Lester Holt or Kristen Welker as one of the moderators. And remember, Welker was a moderator in 2020. Holt was a moderator in 2016. So maybe they get another one. The RNC and Trump, they're not going to attend that because they know, like Welker in 2020, I remember I wrote about this, that the topics that she picked were something like, climate change, which was already in the first debate, but hell, let's do it again, because obviously that will make Biden look compassionate and Trump look like he's trying to destroy the world, right? Race relations was one topic. In other words, there was nothing of real substance that people care about. So if NBC gets a debate, then they're going to back out. Or even CNN, what if they get a debate? You think the RNC is going to agree to that, considering what we saw last year with that mutiny that happened over there after that Trump town hall? No. So maybe Fox gets one, as we should. And I'm not saying that because I work for the company as a contributor. I just think Brett Baer, when he's interviewed Donald Trump, has asked tough but fair questions. And he's stuck to policy for the most part. So if we could do that, or Martha McCallum for that matter, or Bill Hemmer would be excellent, I think, by the way, or even Dana. Dana probably wouldn't get it because she's a former White House press secretary, so there would be some political stuff there. But she's shown that she could be completely objective. I don't know if you've watched America's Newsroom, but boy, that is a real newscast, as is Special Report with Brett. So we should get one, but there'll still be two others. And I don't know. I could see both sides finding a way to back out. I think Trump ultimately would do it anyway because he knows that in that situation, as long as Trump does this, and take my advice on this, if you're listening, Mr. President, which I heard you do listen to Jimmy's show, all you do is answer the question in 45 seconds to a minute as far as what would you do as far as fixing the border. And then you list all the things that I just named, for example. And you say, and I want to, I'll allot my time, my remaining time to Joe Biden. He could explain why he doesn't like a wall, or he doesn't want to start construction again, or what's wrong with Remain in Mexico, right, or Title 42. And let Joe Biden twist in the wind there when he actually has to speak outside of a teleprompter and defend the indefensible. That would be the smart thing to do, but I have a feeling Trump will use his time and then some. But overall, this is a winnable election as we will ever see, people. If you want to go back, Reagan, Carter, 1980, except Trump ain't Reagan, and there's a lot of people that will vote against Trump just because he's Trump when they probably didn't do that with Reagan. But either way, we'll be back with so much more, because we have Lexi Rigdon coming up. She's a criminal defense attorney and a good one. I don't know if you've seen her on Fox lately, but she'll be talking about these legal cases more and where they are headed. This is Joe Concha in for Jimmy Fallon. It is Fox Across America. Back with more in just a moment.
The critics have spoken.
Well, that was different. Yep, lousy, but different.
You're listening to Fox Across America with Jimmy Fallon.
You talked to us about a bevy of things over the years. Man still running. Four indictments, 91 counts, and the man gets more campaign dollars. Climbing in the polls, okay? And last time I checked, he still ain't been in cuffs. He still ain't been put behind bars. And he's the presumptive GOP nominee. You can't stop him. You cannot stop him. And so for me, I find myself ashamed of the Democratic Party for their lack of a competitive fervor. You had since 2016 to come up with somebody else. And you still can't do it. That is pathetic. It is pathetic. And it is no excuse for it whatsoever. It is 2024. In 8 years, you should have been able to find somebody that can compete with this man other than a soon-to-be 82-year-old incumbent.
Wow. Stephen A. Smith of ESPN. I wonder if he gets paid by the word, because that would be one hell of a contract. He's on, like, all the time. I mean, people say, oh, Joe, you're on a lot. Not Stephen A. Smith level on a lot. Let's unpack what he was just saying. He's right. 8 years. 8 years you had to find someone else other than Joe Biden. I think Democrats were so sure that Hillary Clinton would win that they didn't really think about, you know, what to do after. And then when that field came out in 2019, 27 Democrats ran for president. You got everybody from Marianne Williamson to Cory Booker to Julian Castro. I'm just going off the top of my head as far as Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg. And you look at these candidates, you're like, none of these people can win. They have all their certain flaws that they're not going to be able to overcome. And then Joe Biden, well, he was the safest option because he was a former vice president, somewhat moderate. Remember, Joe Biden used to talk about border security, and he used to brag how he secured funding for hundreds of miles of border fence. And this is Joe Biden saying this. Can you imagine? Has he met the new Joe Biden? So I guess they figured, all right, the Obama years were pretty good to us, so people will associate Biden with Obama, and that's the safest pick, and it's good enough. And then he's probably the luckiest person on earth, Biden, because he should have been finished politically when he was caught plagiarizing during the 1988 presidential campaign. That should have been the end of him, but no. And eventually hung around, and then a pandemic got him into office. Without that, Trump wins. I think what Stephen A. Smith is saying is true, but I don't know who that backup is. You tell me. Is it Gavin Newsom? Make America California again? I don't think so. Joe Concha, in for Jimmy Fallon. Back with more in a moment.
It's America's Life Coach, Fox Across America with Jimmy Fallon.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Joe Concha in for Jimmy Fallon. Your toll-free number, 888-788-9910. If you wish to opine. Wow, we're coming up on, you know, about 25 minutes to 3 o'clock here on the East Coast. And if you're at work until, let's see, I'll be on evening edit on Fox Business at 5:30. Then I'll be on Hannity tonight at 9:45, I think they said. Then I get to go on Fox and Friends tomorrow at 6:40 in the morning. Not complaining. It's a labor of love. But the point is that I'll be working a lot, and I have worked a lot, particularly this week with the whole NBC, Rona McDaniel stuff. I think every show on Fox now has officially booked me. So congratulations to everybody on that decision. But the point is, I'm looking at the president's schedule, you know, the commander-in-chief of our armed forces, president of 340 million people and arguably the leader of the free world. And his weekend begins in 25 minutes. Isn't that nice? Off to Camp David for another long weekend. He'll be there the rest of the day today, Saturday, Sunday, comes back Monday afternoon. It's an election year. And this guy works something like, I read a stat, he is on vacation 40% of the time during this presidency. You know what 40% is? When you look at a week, that's basically every weekend is a 3-day weekend. That's 40%. That's not bad. Imagine that. Like, it's Memorial Day. It's Labor Day. Every weekend. That's nice. I got to sign up for this. And you get paid $400,000. And you get your own plane. And you never have to pay for, like, one meal or drink ever. It's not a bad job. Maybe I should pursue this. What do you think, Lexi? You're going to be the first female president of all time, given all the perks. Lexi Rigdon, criminal defense attorney.
I think I deserve all of that. I think I deserve long weekends, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It sounds like a really great gig.
And yeah, I totally, right? Are you booked anywhere this weekend? You're a future Fox News contributor, so I figure, you know, they got to be warming you up by now, right?
Yes. Aren't you sweet? No, but if anybody's asking. But I'm actually going to London next week, so I'm more focused on that, actually.
Wow, is that right?
Yes,
vacation,
I am.
Or what do you got?
Yeah, I'm taking my son, a mother-son trip, and he's 9 years old, so I don't know how that's going to go, but I'm very excited.
9 years old. Has he ever flown internationally before?
No, he's flown to Oregon, and he's been complaining about the length of that flight, you know, for the 5 years since.
It's about
so
even,
this
right?
This is not going to be the easiest. Yeah, and that's only like 5 or 6 hours. So this is definitely, definitely different. But with my luck, the offers will pour in next week.
Yes.
That's what always happens.
Oh, that's too funny. Yeah, I took my kids to one of the perks of the job is I was invited to do a cruise. Like, in other words, the cruise is free, right, through the Media Research Center. And the cruise left Venice, basically, and we went to Croatia, then back around the boot and some other places on the Italian Riviera. And the flight to Venice is something like 7.5 hours. You know, it's brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And they never flew further than Disney before, like 2.5 hours. So it was tough, you know. I mean, you got to have a lot of movies. Hopefully the plane, you know, has a type of thing, touch screen, put on a movie, and just hope that he could watch two back-to-back that he hasn't seen before. I'll give you some recommendations when we get off. And that's the only way you'll survive, because otherwise it's not fun.
100%. I totally agree. And I went to Venice without him. That's a trip to take also without the kids, too.
Oh, wow. Venice is okay. After about 4 hours, I'm like, all right, I get it. Can we move on?
Well, when I was there last summer, it kept flooding. And so you'd turn a corner and then it would be like, oh, can't walk there. But then there were some very, I mean, maybe you'd call them brave or stupid people that would just take their shoes off and walk barefoot through the water. And I was sickened. I'm no germaphobe, but I mean, can you imagine how dirty that water actually is?
Yeah, you look
and
at it,
I'm
you can't
like,
see.
I can't believe people are doing this.
I know. I mean, it's a pretty city, and St. Mark's Place, that whole thing, the way that opens up is nice. But yeah, I think you could do like a day, a night, and then the next day move on to, you know, somewhere else like Tuscany or whatever. But we're going off on a tangent because what we want to talk to you about,
yes,
since you are the expert in these matters, as per all of your Fox News appearances, are the Trump trials. So let's rank them, shall we, as far as one that has no teeth, ain't going anywhere, Trump shouldn't have to worry about it from a legal perspective. And then from there, we'll go to what could be the most damaging to him if somehow these trials are carried out before Election Day, which increasingly it looks like none of them will, given all the delays. So let's start first with Alvin Bragg, hush money, New York, statute of limitations. What the hell is that? Is this thing going anywhere? Because even liberal legal analysts will say this dog don't hunt.
Yeah, I think that the only reason that that one even got so much attention is because it was the first one, because it's really kind of like the most minor one. It's a state case. The falsifying business records would ultimately be a misdemeanor, but they're trying to make it into a felony, alleging campaign violations. Nobody seems too worried about that. And I found it funny that Alvin Bragg, where he clearly loved to be the first person that was able to do this, when the Trump team asked for an adjournment, he's like, sure. So, I mean, I think that that trial will probably be going before the election, but I don't think that the penalties are very severe. And I frankly just don't think anybody cares. Nobody cares about the hush money thing. Like, we don't care. We understand that, you know, he may or may not have done things with certain women in his long life. And I really just don't think people care.
They don't care. And I think also, Lexi, they see what's going on in New York, right, as far as these horrible crimes of people constantly being pushed in front of subway cars, New York City, police officers, targets shot dead. You know, Alvin Bragg should be doing his job as what a real district attorney would be doing, which is actually, you know, prosecuting real crimes instead of pursuing this. So I agree with you. I think that's the weakest of the bunch. All right. Fannie Willis. Actually, no, this may be the weakest of the bunch, considering how toxic she is down there. Do you think she'll be removed from this case altogether? I know the judge is deliberating on that as we speak.
You know, I know I know that the judge didn't, and now they're appealing it. Ultimately, I don't. I was a little bit disappointed in the decision because I really thought that he might have the, you know,
guts,
the stomach to do it. And unfortunately, he didn't. He kind of split the baby, and now it's going to be appealed. It's going to take a long time. And if his legal underpinnings of his decision were accurate, then the appellate division, depending on the standard they're using, might just affirm it. But I think that the case is now so tainted. You couldn't make this up. Like, you could not get a better scenario for the people that are deriding this prosecution to say, look how corrupt this is, because it sort of started seeming politically motivated and corrupt. And then you look into this, the damage has already been done. So whether she stays on the case or not, the damage has been done in the sense that this is not being tried before November. And if she's still on it, then people are going to look askance at it, and there are going to be a lot of people scratching their heads and being like, really, regardless of what happens. So this was a fantastic development that Ashley Merchant blew the lid off of for this to happen. And in terms of like the strength of the case, I mean, again, this is so novel. That's what we keep hearing with these cases. They're unprecedented. They're novel. So nobody really knows if the legal underpinnings are there, but I'm sure you could find a jury unanimously in Fulton County that's overwhelmingly blue to do whatever they can to take down Trump. If it in fact gets to trial, which, I mean, it seems like it will, but there have already been some issues. They dropped some of the charges because the DA's office didn't do them right. So who knows? Who knows what's going to happen with this one?
Yeah, Keystone Cops down there for sure. And plus, it's a RICO case. So despite Congressman or Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying that RICO is not a crime, it is a category. No, it is a crime, and they're very hard to prosecute,
yes,
right? Because you've got to get, what, 18 people down there to testify? That just sounds very long to me, that I can't see this going off before the election day.
Yes, logistically, they're hard to prosecute. Substantively, they always say that it's a prosecutor's best friend or whatever, because you can implicate people in crimes that they didn't really have anything to do with under the theory that everybody was part of this big criminal enterprise.
Yeah.
So prosecutors love it. Defense attorneys hate it. But the logistics of trying a case like that, I mean, look at the Young Thug trial. That's also going on in Atlanta. That is a RICO case. That has a lot more witnesses. But it has multi defendants, actually technically fewer defendants than there are in the Trump case, at least right now in that trial. And one of the attorneys in that case said, and I have to think this might be hyperbole, that at the rate that they're going, it might go into 2027. So, I mean, if that's any indication about how complicated and convoluted,
wow,
and logistically difficult, I can't imagine that's the case. But that's what one of the defense attorneys said, and I really caught my eye because I thought, my God, like 2027, I mean, we're going to be in a whole different world by then.
I've never heard that year thrown out until now.
Right? Like,
yeah,
it's not even like upcoming. You know, we're talking about 2025 stuff. And so this would be a massive undertaking. Is this not going to happen before the election, which – even if he were convicted, I mean, he can't pardon himself if he were to win because it's a state case. But
yeah,
it's, you know, he wants to get over that hump. He doesn't want to be in the middle of a trial in election season.
Wow. 2027, you'll be approaching your 40s by that time, Lexi. Think about that for a moment.
Okay? Approaching, yes.
Yes. Just go along with it. No one knows better. Yeah, and that's the thing. She should have been removed from this case. You don't have to comment on it. I'm just going to make a final thought on this.
Yeah.
Once you perjure yourself, that should be the end. And she perjured herself on multiple occasions. But obviously, the judge had a soft spot for her for reasons that are pretty obvious. Okay, next, let's go with, boy, I never thought I'd be doing this in 2024, where I have to basically spin a wheel as far as what trial I want to talk about when we're talking about a former president. All right, how about the Mar-a-Lago documents, Jack Smith?
See, that one to me, I think, is a little bit – is probably the most troubling, because it's not that he had the documents. We know Biden had documents. We know that people have been careless about these documents. It's the allegations of an attempted cover-up.
Yeah.
That I think are the biggest problem. So in terms of the actual legality of the case, that one to me is on more solid footing than the other ones, I think,
okay,
personally.
Is that going to be – do you see that happening before Election Day, or is that facing a delay? I know the Supreme Court is going – listening to the whole presidential immunity aspect of all this. Does that apply to this case? This is where I get confused. Or is that the D.C. case?
Well, the presidential immunity case was the D.C. case, because
right,
that involves acts criminal act done while the person was president. This was outside of – this was well after he was president that he is alleged to have not responded to the subpoenas, encouraged his attorneys to do some underhanded stuff in terms of the documents. So that's a whole different thing.
Okay.
But I think the last I heard, and I could be wrong, but I mean, I'm never wrong, but I could be wrong.
this would
be the first time I was wrong. But I thought that was scheduled for May. But with all of the other delays, that these dates are just – they're almost like a wish list for the prosecution. Like, who really knows?
Right, because if this were a normal person, then no way this gets heard by May. And I just find it so rich that all of these cases, they sat on them for 2 years just so they could time it with the election. I think that's pretty obvious to most people when we're talking to Lexi Rigdon. So what made you want to be we'll just go on a little tangent for a moment, a lawyer? I mean, for a lot of those people
there are
out
a lot
there.
Of, you know, it's funny. I actually wanted to get into TV news. I grew up in TV. My mom was an anchor, reporter, weather person in CBS Philly. Shout out CBS Philly for many, many years. And it was kind of just in the blood. And I decided instead of just going into a job right out of college where, I mean, those reporters in small markets, they make peanuts. Everyone, I mean, they just, you know, 20 grand a year, whatever it is.
I know.
I decided to go into law, and I figured I'm going to be able to put this to good use at some point. I'll either practice, I'll use it to talk to Joe Concha one day on a radio show.
Yes.
So I kind of was like, it's never going to be a bad thing for me to get a law degree. And my parents always stressed education. So I do like practicing law, actually. I think I'm good at it. I do a good job in the areas that I'm in. They suit my personality. I do criminal and family law. And the new stuff is the icing on the cake. I love doing that too. I love legal analysis, but that's kind of how it started. I always had the goal to do what I'm doing now with Fox and other places.
There you go. All right. Well, you certainly know how to make an argument. So you got that part down and nice hair. So,
and to argue. Yeah.
Those are the two biggest factors, husband. Apparently. good stuff. What's your husband do, by the way?
He's a lawyer too.
You met in law school type of thing?
Well, you know, I'm actually divorced. He's my second husband. I met my first husband in law school. So everybody I marry, my third husband will also be a lawyer.
Yeah, it's weird. My wife keeps referring to me as her practice husband. I'm like, what does that mean exactly? So, but the practice thing has been going on for 10 years. So I think we're past that point. Let's talk about actually totally shifting gears because Major League Baseball, I know the Dodgers and Padres played like 2 weeks ago in Seoul, but I'm not counting it, damn it. Major League Baseball opened the season basically yesterday. With the Yankees, locally anyway, topping the Houston Astros, came back from 4-0. Juan Soto, great throw to stop a Astros player from tying the game in the ninth, and I could go on about that, but I want to talk about the Dodgers, and particularly the highest paid player in baseball, which he's been here in the league for 6 years, Shohei Ohtani, and the guy can't speak English still? I mean, wouldn't it behoove you to learn the language at some point? You need these interpreters that end up probably stealing money from you and betting all this money. So where do you land on all this? You think that Ohtani was actually involved? Is he a victim? What happens next? It seems like the fans, they gave him a standing ovation at Dodger Stadium yesterday. So I don't think it's going to have too much of an impact on him. But I'll let you have the floor for 2 minutes. Yeah.
That's so funny because I said that too. I'm like, come on. Like, in the off season, you can't hire a private tutor. Like, you got all the money in the world. Like, you would think you would want to. If I lived in Japan, I'd want to learn the language. I would not want to be beholden to somebody feeding me information all the time. But in any event, I wrote an article for this on OutKick. I am, like I said, I'm never wrong until I am. I'm wrong frequently. But that's more so in my personal life. But, you know, I really do think that he had there's more to the story than what he's saying. I do not 100% believe him. Now, I'm not saying that he is outright lying and it's a black and white situation, but I mean, maybe I could say that given his statement, because his statement was emphatic and unequivocal, and it was, I had nothing to do with this. And I don't believe it. I think it defies logic. First of all, the interpreter is a liar, so he's hard to trust either way.
Yeah.
But the first story that he came out with was much more believable, and that story was, Ohtani was involved. He was trying to help me out. He was paying off the debts. And that is much more believable between two men, one of whom is not a man of means, the interpreter, and then one of whom is super, super wealthy, to be helping some. It would make sense that your friend is going to step in and say, all right, you're a knucklehead. You got to stop the gambling, but I'll bail you out this time. And it doesn't make sense that Mizuhara would have had access to his bank accounts. He's not his money manager. it wouldn't make sense that as close as these guys were, I think Mizuhara described them as brothers, that he wouldn't know that his friend gambled, let alone had a gambling problem, because I think Ohtani even said, I didn't even know he gambled. And so those two things in and of themselves, taken together, are inherently unbelievable. So that's why I do think that there is something more. And he only changed his story, Mizuhara, when Ohtani came out and said, I've been a victim of theft. So I do I do think he knows more than he was saying.
Gee, just get an online gambling account and it's all legal and you're fine. I don't get why they had to go through this, but I guess it was the amount of money that they were trying to hide. And you know, there's taxes around that. But anyway, I mean, told that we have to break, you know what a hard out is. So Lexi, great to talk to you finally in an interview type of format. And have fun in England with your 9-year-old. I want stories when you get back.
Definitely. We'll do.
All right,
thanks
done deal.
A lot, Joe.
All right, take care. This is Joe Concha in for Jimmy Failla. We wrap this puppy up in just a moment.
This is Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
And welcome back, everybody. Joe Concha in for Jimmy Failla. We're in the final stretch of this wonderful show, Fox Across America. And, you know who sucks now, to be totally honest with you? Drudge. You ever go to Drudge lately? I can't tell a difference between this and HuffPost. Honestly. I mean, every headline's negative towards Trump. It cheers on Biden. I got to think his traffic is, like, way down. I don't know where this comes from exactly, but it's just annoying. And the guy never speaks, so you never can't even ask him, like, what are you doing to your site exactly? Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. And you have a great Easter weekend, at least here in the East Coast, sunny and warm. Texas, I see it's going to be sunny and warm. Just enjoy it with your family, no matter what the weather is. Talk to you soon. See you when I see you. Joe Concha, out.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.